identity. But now that US soccer has gone away from that.
I kind of disagree with that. US soccer, since it was a latecomer on the scene, it didn't have a traditional kit, and it's always kind of been these fun kits. We had the 94 one, the denim kit. Like, that's it wasn't a classic initially, but it's become a classic. I kind of actually enjoy the different uniforms. I can wear different uniforms with every article of clothing now, pretty much. So,
and as an England fan, I would say I agree with Josh, because as an England fan, I've had to put up with a whole lifetime of variations on a white jersey. So it's kind of nice, I think, that, you know, the US has got three colors to play with, and that they can be arranged into any combination. You can have the stripes, red and white stripes. You can have the stars, as with the denim kit. You can get the American flag into all kinds of jersey-related combinations, and this is just the most recent.
Yeah, I just hope that the U.S. plays well in the jersey. I don't really, if we're going to really talk about it, you know, I don't really care what the U.S. wears. You know, they can wear burlap sacks. If they're the best team in the world, let's go burlap sacks all the way. So I think a lot of people might be finding things to poke at where there's really no there.
And the good news is, if you really don't like the new jerseys and you really love the old jerseys, then the old jerseys will be on sale.
This is true.
Yeah, which, in my opinion, is the way to buy soccer jerseys, because they're overpriced. Anyway, we are coming towards the end of the radio show. Before we say goodbye, we need to announce our game of the week. This is the game that we watch and then review on the Sunday podcast, which you can find at
TotalSoccerShow.com.
Thank you, Josh. And our game of the week is...
It is Bayer Leverkusen versus Hoffenheim. Both these teams are in the top half of the Bundesliga, and it's on 2:30 on Friday, Eastern. So if you can't watch it, it is on ESPN3.com, so you can still go home and watch it this weekend at any time.
And for those not familiar with the Bundesliga, it is, of course, in Germany, but there will be some American involvement. Isn't that right, Al?
Yeah, on Hoffenheim, you have recent U.S. men's national team call-ups, Fabian Johnson and Danny Williams playing. Hopefully, we'll get to see those guys in action in the Bundesliga.
Yeah, especially after seeing the way Fabian Johnson played for the U.S. against Slovenia in his most recent game. I know also for Leverkusen, David Yeldell is their goalkeeper, but he's their reserve goalkeeper, so we won't be seeing him. But we'll probably see Michael Ballack. Everyone knows Michael Ballack, and I believe he'll be wearing some sort of crazy face mask, so that's worth tuning in for. And Bayer Leverkusen recently beat Chelsea in the Champions League 2-1. They are no mugs. So yeah, that's Friday, 2:30, ESPN3.com. Our review will be out Sunday at TotalSoccerShow.com. All that remains is for me to stop talking and for Albert to say goodbye.
Goodbye.
And for Josh to say goodbye.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. We'll talk to you soon.
Going to play some local news for you in a bit, and right after that is going to be our live show, Mental Health Matters. But first, every Sunday for almost 18 years, Richmond Food Not Bombs has provided a free vegetarian community meal in Monroe Park, and they depend on volunteers and donations to make it happen. If you would like to help out, Food Not Bombs has set up collection sites for dry and canned foods around Richmond. You can find a box at Lamplighter Roasting Company, 116 South Addison Street, at Crossroads Coffee and Ice Cream, 26 North Morris Street, and at Rumors Boutique, 404 North Harrison Street. For more information and drop-off sites, you can drop an email to rvafoodnotbombs@gmail.com.
In Richmond, I'm Will Snyder with these headlines. In step with a national trend, Virginia has cut funding for tobacco prevention programs. Several states are cutting funding to the programs as they face looming budget shortfalls. Virginia is not immune to the economic crunch either. As a result, funding dropped from $14.5 million in 2008 to just over $8 million this year. Roughly 70,000 school children participate in tobacco prevention programs in Virginia. That number is expected to drop with the funding cuts. Charlottesville police evicted Occupy Charlotte protesters from Lee Park last night. The raid resulted in 18 arrests. Protesters had a special use permit for the park, but it expired Wednesday night. Police were then able to enforce the 11 p.m. closing time for the park. The eviction was complete by 1 a.m. While the number of arrested was high, the police reported that the proceedings were orderly and nonviolent. At Virginia's farm and forest exports rose 5% this year. Agriculture is the state's largest industry and accounted for over $2 billion worth of exported products in 2010. Headlines are produced by Richmond Public Radio, a project of the Virginia Center for the Public Press.
Be happy. In every life we have some trouble, but when you worry you make it.
Hi, this is Gail Mouskowitz, and you are listening to Mental Health Matters. It is an absolutely beautiful, beautiful day on the first day of December in 2011, and I appreciate you tuning in today, and we're going to talk about a subject that is near and dear to my heart, and that is, how do we talk about severe forms of mental illness without using pejorative words, without blaming the individual who suffers? And specifically, actually, we're going to talk about one particular diagnostic entity that comes up over and over again from people who should know better, often therapists, often people who have some of the jargon and can throw it away. And that is the mental illness called borderline personality disorder. We're going to get back to that in a minute. You're listening to Mental Health Matters here on WRIR 97.3 FM on your radio dial in Richmond, Virginia. My name is Gail Mouskowitz, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I've been privileged to practice in the Richmond community for more years than I probably ought to be telling you, but for a long time. Mental Health Matters is a program dedicated to issues pertaining to mental health. I do want to tell you that next week we are going to start a two-part series on adoption. Two women from Jewish Family Services are going to come and talk to us about all of the issues in regard to adoption, including issues of loss and attachment and hope, and then some of the more practical pieces of how one goes through the process of moving toward adoption. By the way, this is National Adoption Month, so it's a very timely topic, and I'm looking forward to getting started on it. So Mental Health Matters is a program dedicated to issues pertaining to mental health in every way, interpersonal relations, addiction, sex, sexuality. I like to discuss healthy ways for us to be more thoughtful about our lives, more emotionally honest, and begin to pinpoint ways that we might be able to fulfill our lives, create our own destiny in more thoughtful, more clear, more mindful ways. You know, all of us have things we struggle with. All of us have emotional problems. All of us get blind to our own stupidity at times, and we get confused, we get sad, we get depressed, we get scared. We all have a million different emotional responses to things, and yet we have such a hard time talking about mental health issues. We underfund mental health programs horribly. We have morally confused notions of how to manage our own pain, and we're very judgmental about how others manage their pain. So each week on Mental Health Matters, I introduce a topic, I discuss the topic either from my own body of knowledge or have a knowledgeable guest, like next week when we'll have the women from Jewish Family Services come and talk about adoption. And early next year, we're going to have somebody from the Department of Mental Health coming to talk. And so I either talk about, I introduce a topic and I either talk about the topic from the body of my own knowledge, or I have an informed expert come talk about the subject. Then I give you, the audience, an opportunity to call in, ask questions, or weigh in on the subject. The number at which to reach us today is 649-9737, 649-9737. Mental Health Matters comes to you every Thursday at 1 p.m. here on WRIR. You're welcome to be in touch with me via email by getting onto our website, www.wrir.org. RIR.org. Once you get on that website, you can just click my program, and that'll give you links to my own personal website and my email. My email, for those of you who'd like to know, is UR, those letters, U and the letter R, Your Mental Health Matters, all one word, at gmail.com, and I'd love to hear from you. Quickly, I want to tell you that I got this letter this week asking me about how to access psychiatric care in Richmond. And I would like to do a show, which I think I'm going to try to aim to do early next year, on how to access any kind of mental health care. But in particular, it is difficult at times to figure out how to get referrals to psychiatrists. So one can look at whether or not medication is an appropriate choice for you. And this individual asked me to help them through the muck of trying to get those referrals. It is really stressful when you have problems already and you can't even go and access help. So I want to let you know that there are some really good psychiatrists in the Richmond area, and I'm going to discuss how one accesses the mental health field, how to get to help. We will pinpoint that on a show early in January, and I individually will respond to the person who sent me an email, which I have actually done already. Anyway, we're going to get back to talking about borderline personality disorder and what that is and why it is so important to highlight it on the show today. Again, this is Gail Moskowitz. You're listening to Mental Health Matters. And if you have any questions for me today, please feel free to call at 649-9737. Okay, so what is borderline personality disorder? First of all, it's always confusing to me when I'm talking about just the whole notion of personality disorder and why we would say somebody's personality is disordered. Well, that's how it is coded in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And that's the nomenclature. That's the word we use. But to really think about that somebody's personality is disordered, in and of itself, that just seems pejorative to me. But I'm going to kind of suspend my thoughts about that right now, because that's a whole philosophical conversation we're not going to get into right now. And I'm going to speak specifically to the kinds of things that people who are diagnosed with this disorder struggle with, because it's a very difficult disorder to manage. So individuals who suffer from borderline personality disorder have the following list of problems. They have a constant sense of frenetically working against being abandoned, that everything feels like abandonment to them. So they're constantly in this effort to avoid being abandoned. And the abandonment is either something either imagined or real. They may be getting abandoned because people move away from people who have borderline personality disorder because they can be exhausting to be around. So in a way, people with borderline personality disorder get in their own way. They undermine their own efforts to have people stay in their lives. So they have a frantic effort to avoid real or imagined abandonment. They have a consistent pattern of intensely crazy, unstable relationships. They have a consistent pattern of unstable relationships. They go from highs to lows with those they're connected with. They often see people as, oh my God, perfect, idealized, this is the best human being ever, to being just really disappointed, then they devalue that person. So either you're in or you're out. You're good or you're bad. You're with them or you're against them. And they go, even in a relationship with someone, from hot to cold, hot to cold. And the people who are attracted to individuals who have this kind of intensity in a relationship often have a set of their own problems. They have a lot of difficulty in their own sense of identity. They don't know who they are. They can't define themselves. I don't know what I want. I don't know what I think. I don't know who I am. Only it feels deeper than that. They can't tell you. They don't feel comfortable in their own skin. Their identity is sort of disturbed. They feel unstable inside of themselves at their very sense of who they are. They are very impulsive. And I'll give you some information, which is that people with borderline personality disorder probably make up about 10% of individuals who go for help, who go to community mental health centers, who go for help. It's really a very difficult diagnostic picture to manage inside oneself. And these individuals are more likely to have a suicide attempt. And then, of course, the more you attempt, the more likely you are to be successful. So they become very impulsive. One of the things they do is they become impulsive in things that might not be a direct suicide attempt, but things that could kill them, like sex binges, unsafe sex, sex with people they don't know, trying to get people to hold them, take care of them, love them, even if it's just for those little bits of time that they feel comfort or comforted in their relationships with other people, in their sexual relationships with other people. They have substance abuse issues. They drive recklessly. They are adrenaline junkies. They're impulsive in their suicide gestures, threats, and one of the things we're going to see a lot is self-mutilating behavior, people who cut themselves. It's an interesting thought, the whole thought of people who cut themselves. And again, that might be an interesting show to do. Why do people cut themselves? I'm going to tell you something. Understand this, okay? Can you think about a time when you've hurt yourself, broke a leg, cut a finger, whatever, and that first response to hurting yourself, cutting your finger, skinning your knee, is almost feeling like something coats your body and stops you from feeling that pain. We might call it, oh my gosh, we feel shock, or we go into shock. But it stops us from feeling pain. And that is because in response to that kind of thwart to one's body, our brain creates an analgesic effect that soothes us, that comes over us. And people who self-harm almost become addicted, or perhaps do become addicted to this analgesic effect of getting addicted to this brain chemistry. And so they feel the intensity of that, then they feel the intensity of the pain, and they get a significant amount of attention for this. And this is something with people who have borderline personality disorder are much more apt to do than anybody else. They punch themselves, they hit their heads, they cut themselves. So this recurrent kind of suicidal behavior or gestures or threats, you're going to see all of this. People who have an absolutely, they seem to have an inability on any level to manage their own mood state. They can't manage themselves. They can't keep a mood equilibrium. They descend into despair. They have horrible episodes of despondency. They're irritable or they're anxious. They just become horribly angry and in response to something. So, you know, when you have something happen to you and you have an emotional response to it, let's say somebody hurts your feelings. Well, most of us are able to sort of allow ourselves to feel our feelings be hurt and manage that feeling and deal with what that's like to have our feelings hurt, and then get ourselves back, calm down, and then make some kind of cogent decision about what to do with that feeling. But people with borderline personality disorder never stop. There's no break in the circuit from feeling the feeling and acting on the feeling. So if they're irritable, they're irritable. If they're angry, they're angry. And how you can sort of see this is if you look and see how a two-year-old responds to the world. They're happy, they're sad, they're angry, they're sleepy, they sleep, they're hungry, they eat. And as adults, as we age, we're supposed to be able to regulate those things. We're supposed to be able to postpone. We're supposed to have the frustration tolerance to put off having our needs met right away. But people with borderline personality disorder have a really difficult time doing that. The emotion hits, and they have no skills to manage their emotions in the here and now. And that's the thing that becomes so difficult for other people in relation to people who have borderline personality disorder. And that is why we move away from these individuals. Because if they're angry, they're in your face. And if they're sad, they've pulled away and they have nothing to say. It's very difficult. People with borderline personality disorder have really inappropriate anger, very intense anger. They have an inability to control the expression of anger. And they have temper tantrums. They might get themselves in fights. They might break things. And it never ends well because they don't get the desired result. They have no skills to, how do you manage anger? What do you do when you're mad at somebody? Well, what most of us know is that if we're mad at somebody, that we put it in perspective, it either subsides or we let the person know we were irritated, or, you know, oh, we vent to a friend. But that's not something that people with borderline personality disorder can do. And it really backfires for them, which makes their lives really, you know, untenable. And they lay themselves open for very harsh judgment. So one of the things that begins to happen for people with borderline personality disorder is they almost have sort of they feel detached from themselves. We call these dissociative symptoms. They feel detached from themselves. They feel empty. They feel numb. They might begin to feel like people are really, really after them because they overuse the emotional defense mechanism of projection, which is everything they feel, they project onto you. So if they feel sad that day or they feel like they don't look good, they'll project it onto you that you think they don't think that you think they don't look good, and therefore they're going to get mad at you. No matter what you do, you're going to prove to them that you think they don't look good. And they begin to get afraid of people. They don't feel safe with people. They feel paranoid, so to speak. And this does not do well for them. And the most important thing that we have to know about people with borderline personality disorder is they have this chronic, chronic feeling of just being empty. Empty, as if they are themselves an empty shell of a person. So, you know, we're going to see that more women than men are going to be diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. In some reports, I've seen them say as much as 75% are women and 25% are men. Men are more likely to be diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder or antisocial personality disorder. And truthfully, if you begin to look at some of these traits, I think they merge in with each other more than we think. But nonetheless, this is something we're going to see. So one of the problems with dealing with having borderline personality disorder is that this individual who has borderline personality disorder may see themselves totally powerless to make changes in their own lives. Their lives don't work. They have horrible relationships. They can't move forward in the things that they would like connection or, you know, to do well at work. And they feel powerless to do anything about it. And the reason they feel powerless to do anything about it is they have a really hard time looking at themselves for the reasons that their life is in a struggle. They externalize all the blame for the crappy things that are happening in their lives. So I will say out loud to everybody who's listening, if your life isn't going well, it is 100% on you to make it different. It's 100% on you to make it different. So we're talking about borderline personality disorder. This is Gail Moskowitz, and you're listening to Mental Health Matters. And if you'd like to be in touch with me today, I'd love to hear from you if you have a question. My number is 649-9737, 649-9737. You're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM here in Richmond, Virginia. We're talking about borderline personality disorder, and I want to get back to some of the things that that we see a lot of in borderline personality disorder. And what I said was that that people who have this disorder either see people as good or bad, good and bad, good and bad. We call it splitting. So what people who have borderline personality disorder do is they feel so needy around people that once they find somebody who might have something to offer them, or they're nice to them, or they seem smart or funny or warm or giving or whatever, or they're physically attracted to them, they feel so desperate inside to feel better that they suck into or stick on to this person with a sense that this person has something to offer them that's going to save them from their own life. And they idealize this individual to the point of absolute no way ever that this individual can live up to the idealized version that people who have borderline personality disorder might see them. So they always fall. And then when they fall, it's over. They're the worst. They're terrible, awful people worthy of hate and disgust. So if you're a person who has a really hard time seeing people as anything but all good and all bad, if you're a person who really struggles with deep, intense, unstable, and unhealthy relationships, if you're a person who tries to hurt themselves in order to feel better, if you have some of these symptoms, and one of the things about borderline personality disorder is, you know, nothing is black and white. Maybe you have some of these symptoms and not all of them. But what I want to say to you are three things. One, you want to feel better in your life. The first thing you have to do is you have to tell yourself every hour on the hour, I, not anybody else, I have the capacity, I have to be in charge of the capacity that I have for making my life look better to me. And we've talked before about creating your own happiness, but people with borderline personality disorder really are going to have a hard time doing that. So the second thing I would say is you got to go get some help. And you have to go get some help and be able to say, I seem to get in my own way. I am constantly miserable. I think people are either good or bad. I have a hard time getting in the middle. I have been self-harming. I do think of killing myself. And I want to have new skills to look at my life in a way where I feel like I have some control over how I feel. Help me. So you got to go get some help. And you can't go saying, my mother was bad to me. My father was bad for me. That's why my problems are so clear to me today. You know what? Your mother might have been bad to you. A lot of people with borderline personality disorder grew up in very chaotic homes. They grew up in homes where they might have suffered abuse. They might have post-traumatic stress disorder. They might have been raised with somebody who had a severe mental illness, so their relationship to their parents might have felt a little bit more like emotional roulette than clear or consistent or loving. People with borderline personality disorder often have some pretty bad stories to tell. And all of that needs to be taken into account as you begin to harness your ability to manage your own life. And while those things clearly existed in your life, you have to find a way to stipulate to that, yes, these bad things happened, but I have to find a new way to look at them, because you are the only person who can begin to help yourself look at this differently. So, one, you have to identify and go and say, I want new skills to be better. Two, when you go for help, you can't go for help with this belief that everybody else is in the wrong in your life. Everyone else has caused your problems in your life, your neighbor, your boss, your husband, because that won't get you anywhere. And the third thing is that there are some really good treatments for people with borderline personality disorder, things in the lines of cognitive behavioral therapy and some other kinds of things that come from that. One of them is called dialectic behavioral therapy. And there are places in Richmond to get this kind of help. And it's profoundly changing, health changing for people. So get open to the belief that you can do this different. And if somebody's in your life who struggles with these things, calm yourself down first. Make clear boundaries, and we'll talk a little bit more another time about what to do if you're in the life of someone with borderline personality disorder. But our time is up today. This is Gail Moskowitz. You're listening to Mental Health Matters, and I hope you'll tune in next week, 1 o'clock on Thursday afternoon.
Be happy. In every life we have some trouble. When you worry, you make it double. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy now.
Today's voice of recovery is Thomas Williams, who was born in 1911 in Mississippi. By age 5, he had been diagnosed with diphtheria, leaving his legs paralyzed for nearly 2 years. At the age of 13, his mother decided to give him a typewriter. Later in life, Thomas was given the nickname Tennessee and became one of the great playwrights of the 20th century. One of the major inspirations for his female characters was his sister Rose, who had schizophrenia and was further disabled by a botched lobotomy. Tennessee had his own struggles with depression throughout his life, at one point requiring hospitalization. In spite of his struggles with mental illness, Tennessee Williams found a way to have a life worth living. Recovery from mental illness is possible. If you have a mental illness, know that you're not alone. There are millions of us. Voices of Recovery is produced by Daniel Rigsby and David Leon at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia. I'm David, and I'm recovering from a mental illness.
From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College, this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Amandine Lee.
And I'm Colin Smith.
This week on War News Radio, Best of Fall 2011, we highlight some of the best work recently produced.
First, we explore the memories of 9/11.
Then, we learn about Afghanistan's opium economy.
Finally, we learn about a computer scientist analyzing global media to predict revolutions.
This is War News Radio. This September marked the 10th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks on the United States. War News Radio produced a special show focusing on remembering 9/11, and here we listen to the first segment. The events of that day left America reeling and heralded the beginning of the war on terror. Now, the young adults who experienced 9/11 as children are being called the 9/11 generation. A team of War News Radio staff members fanned out to talk to these students, and Caroline Batten examined some of the ways the tragedy has affected them.
On September 11, 2001, almost 3,000 people died in a coordinated Al-Qaeda-planned suicide attack on the World Trade Center's Twin Towers in New York City and the Pentagon. A fourth strike was planned for Washington, D.C., but when passengers intervened, the plane crashed into a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. The attack marked the beginning of a pivotal decade and the start of the longest war in American history. The day was forever seared in Americans' memories, both young and old alike. As we face the 10-year anniversary, the nation is reflecting on the aftermath of the tragedy.
The consequences of our actions are really going to be front and center on the 10th anniversary because, you know, 10 years is a good time to look back and say, what were the implications of this?
That's Elena Reuter, a sophomore at Swarthmore College, a small liberal arts school outside Philadelphia. Reuter is one of the many young adults who witnessed the aftermath of 9/11 at a young age and grew up during what the Bush administration has coined the War on Terror. She and her peers are what a dozen news organizations, as well as President Obama, are calling the 9/11 generation. They say the 9/11 generation appears to be comprised of two groups. One group has become more civic-minded and volunteer-inspired. The other has grown apathetic and cynical, watching the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. War News Radio wanted to see whether these young adults agree with the categorization. But first, we heard from them about the role the 9/11 experience played in their childhood. Jesse Cannizzaro, a 21-year-old senior studying theater at Swarthmore, is from New York City. She was in Manhattan on September 11th and shares vivid memories about the day.
It's so engraved in my memory is this just incredibly strong smell of smoke throughout the city. You know, from uptown to downtown, it just, everything smelled completely of smoke. And I just remember walking around the city getting supplies with my parents and just the, like, coat of dust on everything. And just looking downtown and just seeing the smoke and debris and the wreckage that just stayed with the city.
Ross Adair, a 21-year-old senior now studying political science at Swarthmore, was also in New York City. He, too, remembers startling images from the day.
I remember I was walking downtown, and I remember seeing four or five people who were just walking straight up the street, and they were just covered head to toe in ash, and they looked almost kind of like zombies. They sort of had this faraway look on their face. They were obviously in shock, and, you know, at the time I didn't know what was really going on. So I'd never seen anything like that before. And I just thought it was some sort of like weird prank.
Whether or not they were in New York, many students now recall the day as one of shock and confusion. Most of them were in their class at their elementary schools when they got the news, like Becca Spiegel, now a 21-year-old senior majoring in sociology at Colorado College.
I was in sixth grade. I was sitting in my homeroom class, and we had a little TV up in the corner of the room. And, well, it was early in the morning. We'd probably just gotten to school, and all of a sudden my teacher turned on the TV, and we saw footage of the plane crashing into the second tower, and I remember just being totally confused and unable to understand what was going on. It didn't ever occur to me that this was something that was happening, you know, that was calculated and had been planned out. I just couldn't imagine what had gone wrong watching footage of the incident on TV and it's all of this aftermath and being kind of stunned and horrified and unsure what to make of it overall.
Like Spiegel, the majority of the students who spoke with War News Radio felt that the tragedy taught them important lessons, even if they did not at first understand just what was happening. Cannizzaro, in New York, learned how insecure her city was in that moment.
Just the very fact of knowing that my city that, like, for 11 years I thought was just, you know, indestructible, that no one could touch it, and that someone could, like, come in and destroy so much.
Diana Mask, now a senior studying communications at Susquehanna University, had loved ones in the surrounding area and was forced to confront the concepts of loss and tragedy.
My family is originally from North Jersey, and a lot of close family friends were affected by it. We lost a lot of family friends, and just hearing the stories of people whose cars were left at the train station in New Jersey who just went in for the day and never came back, and just hearing the horror stories in general and just trying to understand the emotional stress and duress that these people were going through. You don't have to have an immediate family member who passed away and that to feel like you've lost a relative or it's more of like an American family.
Similarly, Alex Chow, a 21-year-old chemistry major at the University of Delaware, learned about mortality for the first time.
I guess in some ways I've learned about life and death. I know that during that year my grandfather also died, so even at a very young age, at 10, I began to learn about how fragile life is.
Clinical psychologist Lori Walsh, who was practicing in New York City at the time, explains the effect 9/11 had for most children across the country.
But a lot of kids kind of had their feeling of safety and their feeling of nothing bad kind of will ever happen to me eroded or shaken a little bit. You know, we like to give kids the sense of a firm ground beneath their feet, that they're safe. And in the United States, we've had this luxury of being able to do that for a long, long time. You know, it's a life lesson that we have to give all kids, that